Welcome to The Jury Is Out, a podcast by and for trial lawyers looking for better ways to serve their clients. Your co-hosts are John Simon, founder of the Simon Law Firm, and St. Louis attorney Eric Veith.
Welcome to another episode of The Jury Is Out. I'm Eric Veith.
I'm John Simon.
And today we're here with a guest, Yvette Liebesmann. She is a professor at St. Louis University. She's here today to talk about intellectual property, especially with a slant toward intellectual property and the arts. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So did you want to give a thumbnail, a couple highlights from of what you've done in your career up to now?
Okay. Well, I did lots of things before I even went to law school. I was an oceanographer for a while. I worked in environmental chemistry and then for pharmaceuticals. And I finally rolled around to going to law school when I was 38. I went to Georgetown Law, and after that, I clerked on the New Jersey Supreme Court for a justice there. Then I practiced law in Boston at a firm called Ropes & Gray, where I did intellectual property transactional work, so I helped people buy or sell their patents, trademarks, copyrights. Then I got this wonderful opportunity to be a law professor at SLU.
You've been there for how long now?
This is my 12th year.
Well, John and I often talk about who might be a good type of a guest, and you certainly fit the mold because you do things that we don't normally do. Mm-hmm. Also, this audience, we are assuming, will include a lot of lawyers who are mm-hmm. not specializing in intellectual property, in fact, maybe don't do much of it at all, mm-hmm. and might have a friend or a client walk in mm-hmm. and just say, could you help me with this little matter, this IP matter? Mm-hmm. And what's your reaction to that? Should a general practitioner tread lightly, or how should you approach that kind of problem if you're not normally doing this sort of work?
The best way to think about it is that if I need brain surgery, I don't go to a podiatrist. They're both physicians, but they have different areas of expertise. And the same thing is true for the law. If you want a litigator, you go to someone who litigates. If you want someone who does family law, help you with your divorce, you go to someone who specializes in family law. IP is the same thing. It's some very, very specialized skills.
So maybe we could set the table mm-hmm. with the basic differences between patent, trademark, and copyright and how they might apply to the arts.
Okay. We'll start with patents. Patents are the only one where you don't just get by doing. So a patent is actually a grant by the U.S. government for an invention, for something you have invented. There's actually three kinds of patents, but one most people think about, I have created something useful, something functional. Something like that. I want somebody who can write my patent and represent me before the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, before a patent examiner.
Are there certain things or subjects that can't be patented?
Oh, yes. There's many. You can't patent natural phenomena. You can't patent laws of nature. You can't patent math. So, for example, how do we draw the difference? So, for example, Pascal's equation, if you're a physicist like me, is all about the relationship between area and pressure and volume. And coming up with that equation, nobody can have a patent on that. But if I want to make a hydraulic brakes, that's based on Pascal's equation, I can get a patent for my hydraulic brakes that are based on that natural phenomena. So that's the difference, but that's very important. We don't want people to be able to patent math. We don't want them to be able to patent things that are found in nature, even if they're the first one to discover it.
All right. Should we move on to trademarks?
Sure. Before we go there, we're going to go to trade secrets real quick. Sometimes you can't get a patent, but if you can keep it a secret, you can still get protection. So that's important too. But trademarks. So trademarks are basically brands. It's your brand. So as soon as you are using it, the phrase goes, using it in commerce in connection with goods or services as an indicator of source. So once I start trying to sell my brand, if I have Simon Law Firm and I want to start my practice, and the first thing I do is I print up letterhead and I send it out to people who say, hey, you know, new law firm out here. Even before you have a client, you now have used that mark in commerce. And the first person to use it has what's called priority. And they can stop people from using that mark in a confusingly similar manner. So, for example, we have Delta Faucets and Delta Airlines. Nobody is going to go into Home Depot to buy airline tickets. So I hope not. You can have the same name. It doesn't give you a monopoly over the word name. It just prevents others from using it in a confusingly similar way.
And to what extent would the arts intersect with trademark?
Well, if you have, you're an artist, if you have your brand, every artist has their brand, their name, this is my work. If they have a company, if they are built, if they have a name for their business that is...
Name of a band, maybe?
Exactly. The name of a band.
So I know some things like patents have a statute of limitations mm-hmm. or a time limit. Does that apply to trademarks?
It does not apply to trademarks. You're right. Patents, you get them from 20 years from the date you filed. That's when they expire. And then your invention goes into what's called the public domain where anybody can use. Patents do have that limit. Trademarks can go on forever. As long as you have a business and you're using it as a business and you haven't abandoned it. So this is why when FedEx bought Kinko's, if they didn't keep using the word Kinko's somewhere, it would be abandoned. And then anybody could start calling their business Kinko's Copies. So you'll always see that sign Kinko's Copies here because they don't want to consider abandoning their mark.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we have also copyrights.
Yes. Okay. Well, before we get to that, trademarks, you can register them, but you don't have to. Registration gives you a little more rights, but as soon as you're using it, you have it wherever you have market penetration. Copyright is similar in the sense you don't need to register your copyright to have rights to it. As soon as you fix your creative expression, copyright protects the expression of an idea, but not the idea itself. So, for example, I can write a story about college life in the 1950s and 60s, and I've just both described Mona Lisa Smile and Animal House. So you don't have rights to the idea, but you have rights to your fixed expression of that idea. And you have those rights as soon as you have fixed it on your computer, on a piece of paper, videotaped it.
Are there geographical restrictions on something like a trademark?
There can be. And there's two kinds of geographic restrictions we're talking about. One is if you don't register it, you get where you have market penetration. So you get where people have heard of you and associate that word with you. If you register it, then you have nationwide rights. You're considered having market penetration everywhere in the country. But there's one exception to that, and that's where the geographic limitations come in. There, if you've ever been to Mattoon, Illinois, there is a restaurant there called Burger King. And they were founded in around the mid-50s, about the same time that Burger King in Florida was founded. When Burger King in Florida got their national registration, they sued the ones in Mattoon and said, you have to stop using it. And the court said, no, they get 20 miles around Mattoon, Illinois, and you get the rest of the country. So if you are in existence before somebody gets their federal registration, you get to keep that market.
So does that prevent Burger King from opening a store within 20 miles of Mattoon?
Absolutely. If you go wow. into the Burger King, find a store, and you type in Mattoon, Illinois, I've done this, you will not see one within 20 miles.
Maybe they should license part of their...
they offered a pittance. They offered one year, they offered a pittance of like $10,000.
Okay.
Burger King, yeah. Come on. They could have coughed up more money, but they didn't. And so this Burger King still sits in Mattoon, Illinois. That is not the Burger King that we all think of as Burger King.
So on copyright, if it comes into existence when you create your work, mm-hmm. when you fix the expression, is mm-hmm. that the right way
yes,
to say it?
Yes.
Then what is the advantage of registering?
Okay, well, the big advantage to registering is if you're worried someone may infringe. So in order to sue somebody for copyright infringement, you first have to have registration. Before you can go to court, you have to say, I have a registered copyright. And then it comes down to, if you registered it before the infringement, then you have what's called statutory damages. You can get up to $150,000 per work that's infringed on. And you can also ask for attorney's fees. If you don't register it, the infringement happens, and then you register, you are now limited to actual damages. Actual damages can sometimes be more than statutory damages, but rarely. So, for example, when Victor Whitmell, the tattoo artist, sued Warner Brothers over the Mike Tyson tattoo on Ed Helms' face, you can imagine that's one work. That's that would be max $150,000. But think of the actual damages based on the sales, the gross receipts for that movie, and all the times it was infringed on in that movie. So usually, though, you're talking about a song. A song would cost me $1 to buy, and they can get up to $150,000 from me if I did an unauthorized download.
Wow.
Which is why you had those 12-year-old girls getting sued for like $500,000.
Right, I remember that. That was, yeah. I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? To chilling effect?
Yes.
So, yeah.
So, yeah, that's why. But that's why
middle school kids being sued for $50 million by...
Yes, yeah. By the RIA.
$500,000, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Do you know how much those were typically settled for?
I don't. Some of them didn't settle. The only ones we know about were the ones that didn't settle, and there the courts were not kind to the defendant. There was one woman who was hit up for $250,000.
And that stuck? It held up?
It stuck. It held up.
For downloading like a single song?
She downloaded like 20 songs, I think, but still
a pretty good price.
Yeah, yeah. But what's changed now is back in the day when those things were happening, the record companies made it very difficult to just buy a single song. They wanted you to buy a whole album. So the whole market has changed now with iTunes where it's easy to not infringe.
And so I guess that's why you don't hear about it much anymore.
Exactly.
Everything's more available and
exactly.
Cheap.
Exactly.
Right. I have some examples I'd like to throw your way to see whether it's something protected. For instance, a story plot. Not copying the whole story and selling a copy of the book, a photocopy, but just writing your own book with the same plot.
Well, it depends how the plot is. So, for example, if I tell the story of an orphan who is raised by horrible relatives and then with his friends and a special weapon and a mentor defeats the great evil. I have just described everything from King Arthur to Star Wars to Lion King to you name it. So that general plot is not protectable. But those very specific aspects of it, if my hero has a lightning bolt scar on his forehead, or you hear the sentence, Luke, I'm your father, you know, those kinds of things are protectable. The things that make that story unique, that original expression is. Learned Hand actually talked about this, the idea of think about it like layers, and you can have the core, which is very protectable. And as you get further and further away from the core, you're going to reach an area where things are so not as well defined and they become more an unprotectable idea than a protectable expression.
Is that the same rule or the same approach to people who say, you stole my song? That you look to a core or more specific aspects of it that makes it more protectable as opposed to a chord progression?
Music is very difficult. Music is difficult because there's only so many pleasant sounds you can have. And so that limits it right there. And there's a lot of progressions that are out there. And there you can have a four-chord progression that is very common. And even if I hear it in a song and I copy it and I say, I like that four-chord progression, just because I copied it, I didn't copy anything that you had the right to stop copying. So there can be progressions that are very unique and do get protection. For example, Chuck Berry sued the Beach Boys and won for his Sweet Little 16 and their Surfing USA. You listen to them, it's the same. They copied enough of something that was very unique for it to be actionable.
So is it what takes precedence? Is it the time it's registered or the when it's created?
The time you get protection as soon as it's created. And that's when you actually have copyright, at that moment of creation.
Without doing anything.
That's when you have rights. That's when you can actually go and... So the Digital Millennium Copyright Act allowed for these takedown notices. So if I have a photograph and somebody copies my photograph on their website, I don't even have to deal with them. I can go to the web host and say, I own the copyright. You need registration if you want to sue. And when you file your registration, one of the things on the form it says is when was it first published? In other words, when was it first fixed?
Okay.
And that's the date. So that date is actually part of the registration.
So, but in order to file a lawsuit, you have to have it registered.
Correct. And in fact, the Supreme Court last term said filing for registration is not enough. That the registration must actually be granted. You must actually have that registration before you can file suit.
So do they? What do you need to be able to get it registered? Is it difficult to get it registered?
It costs about $35, and you go online, and you fill out a form, and you submit it electronically, and you're done.
Let's say I took a really unique, beautiful picture of the arch.
Okay.
Can I protect that?
Yes. You have what's called thin copyright. So
What was that? Thin?
Thin copyright.
Okay.
So what that means, you can't stop anybody else from taking the picture, a picture of the arch from the same place with the same camera, same lighting, and everything outside. You don't have the right to that. You have the right to stop people from taking your photograph and making copies of your photograph and distributing your photograph without your permission.
So how has all this online stuff, I guess it's changed, has it changed the law dramatically, or at least the issues that you see?
It's changed it somewhat. It's changed it. It's easier to infringe. It's easier to copy. It's easier to have access to things, which is also good. We have access.
Everything's online, right.
We have access. But you have copyright, even if you don't. I think there's two myths that people forget about, that people think when you're talking about online stuff. One, they think anything online is in the public domain, which is wrong. You can have just as much copyright of something in the online as you do on paper. Even if you don't have the C symbol, you don't have to have that little C copyright and say it's copyrighted for it to be copyrighted. But on the other hand, it's easier for people to put things up there and claim copyright for things that they can't. So one of my favorite examples for this is there's a running chart on one of the web pages that is a pace chart. And it says, okay, if you run this pace, this is how fast you do a 5K all the way up to a marathon. And at the very bottom, it says this table's copyrighted. It's math.
That's what I was just thinking. I was thinking the math.
It's math. Right. You cannot copyright. Copyright is not available for things that are useful, for things that are natural, for anything that is covered by patent law. And also not natural phenomena, mm-hmm. not math.
What do you mean by natural phenomena? What are some examples of that?
I couldn't copyright something like a boulder that I found. Okay, so if I find a tumbleweed, that tumbleweed is a tumbleweed. It's natural. It's naturally occurring.
But if you took a picture of it,
you would have copyright in your picture. But you can't stop other people from taking a picture of it.
Sort of like the arch example.
Exactly. Exactly. So somebody is trying to claim copyright in a math table, which is a law of nature. And so laws of nature are not copyrightable.
When you're creating something, mm-hmm. you already have this vast inventory of things mm-hmm. in your head. And I would imagine sometimes, maybe more often than not, it's inadvertent. Or you hear a tune and you're trying to be creative. So what advice would you give an artist, somebody who has written a song that they feel might be a little too close to something else that's already out there?
Okay, well, first of all, if you're talking about copyright is all about protect copying. So if they heard a song and it influenced them, what part of it influenced them? Did they hear a song, a country western song, and used a similar riff that's available for everybody? Did they say take something that was unique to that particular song? So that's the first thing. What exactly did they copy? Did they copy something that the artist had the right to control or not? There's a fairly famous, at least amongst law professors, IP law professors, a video called Four Chords and 36 Songs. And it is the same four chord progression for 36 songs. Everything from Waltzing Matilda in World War I to Can You See the Love Tonight by, you know, Elton John, to songs by Toto and Michael Jackson and the whole gambit, U2. So they all use the same four chord progression. If I heard that and I said, I'm going to do it myself, and I use that same four chord progression, it didn't matter which song I heard it from, nobody has the right to stop me from using it. So that's the first thing. They may have copied something, but did they copy something that was protectable?
Okay.
That's one. And did they copy enough? How much did they copy? So, yes, so that's the first thing. They may have.
Well, how do you determine that? Did they copy enough of it? Is that subjective?
Or it's fairly,
I guess, what is the if you're in court, what would the instructions say? If you're in court, what would the jury need to find to conclude that the defendant copied the plaintiff's work?
When you go to court, there's three ways to prove copying. So, state, you have to prove copying and unlawful appropriation, that they copied something that they had the right to control. So, first, the jury is going to be asked, was there access, and are they substantially similar? So did they have access to the work, and are they substantially similar? And then they look to see whether or not what was copied was something that belonged to the artist. So there they're looking at the total concept and feel, and that's kind of a little, you know, people have a lot of problems with that, because oftentimes what the jury thinks is being copied isn't something that the artist had the right to control. And there's a lot of problem with music copyright infringement because of that. You know, being a physicist, I always thought the way they should do it is just, you know, use mathematical algorithms of the physics of sound and compare those to figure it out.
It would seem like those would be the toughest cases.
They are.
Yeah.
They are, because it would be like saying, well, they're both rap songs. They're both country western songs, and they sound alike. Well, did they actually
A lot of them out there are the same and
yes,
sound alike.
Exactly.
There was a case in St. Louis that got some press on a movie. Mm-hmm. Was it a movie that had been
Well, copied? we just recently had the case with Marcus Gray versus Katy Perry.
Okay.
And then recent, and we also had the movie case we had a few years back was the Hangover Part 2 case. That was the Mike Tyson tattoo issue.
Okay, yeah.
And that was big. And they settled after the preliminary injunction was denied. So what happened there was, and that's a good, so if I have a tattoo, if I get a tattoo and it's unique and it's visible, the artist is giving me an implied license to live my life. So I can walk in the street without infringing on the public display right. I can appear in movies and have my photo taken. And all of this, because it's on my face, as long as the tattoo on my face is what is where it is, where it's being photographed, where I'm being in the movies and on TV, that's okay. Because I have an implied license to live my life. You can't stop me from doing the things that I would normally do in my life. But I don't have the right to give anybody else permission to put that tattoo on their face. And that was the issue, was not that Mike Tyson was in the movie, but that Ed Helms had the tattoo on his face in the movie.
Okay.
And so only Victor Whitmill, the tattoo artist who owned the copyright in it, had the right to decide who else got to have that tattoo on their face.
You know, John, you mentioned this inadvertent copying. You might have thought it's your idea and you heard it somewhere else. There's a phrase for a term for that, cryptonesia.
And cryptonesia?
Cryptonesia. You stole it, but you didn't know you stole it. You forgot that you knew it.
Actually, George Harrison lost an infringement suit by claiming he unconsciously copied a song. So when he did My Sweet Lord, the authors of He's So Fine said, wait, that's our song. And he's like,
sound a lot like it.
Yes, and he lost an infringement suit because it was.
In one sense, I guess you just play both songs to the jury and see what they think.
That's true, but the problem is they're listening to everything, including the unprotectable things. And so how do you tell them, well, these things are protectable and these things are not? Well, they both sang in a falsetto that you can't protect, but they're hearing it in falsetto, and that's going to shape their minds as to saying, wow, they sound alike. So there are unprotectable parts, and that's the difficult part for the jury, is to filter out the unprotectable parts when they're determining whether there was improper appropriation. I think most artists don't want to copy. They want to be their own unique person and their own unique artist. When you're talking about music here, it's a matter of if they feel that, I would never give them blanket advice, but if they were to come in, and I wouldn't give them any advice at all because I'm not a member of the Missouri Bar, but if they're concerned about a particular riff being too close to theirs and they're concerned about protectability, they can always ask for permission. They can always see about getting a license from the composer of that song.
That's the next thing I was going to ask you.
Sometimes, that phrase, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. Well, sometimes that permission can be very cheap and that forgiveness can be very expensive. Mm-hmm.
So with something like a song, is there some way to verify after you've created it that there's not something else out there like it, like prior art or whatever? I don't know if that's the proper term or not.
It's a similar term. Well, first of all, copyright only prevents you from copying. So independent creation is a complete defense. So if I independently created that song, even if it's similar to yours, unless they can show I had access and they are so similar that it's obvious that I copied.
So that is interesting. That's why, and that's the case because access is an element of their claim.
Exactly.
So if it's yours and you created it, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm. And they both may have been copied from another source that's in the public domain, Or so the example I always use in my class with my students taking lecture notes, I say every one of you is independently creating lecture notes, but they're all going to be similar, I hope, because they're coming from the same source, my lecture. So you're not, nobody is infringing on anybody else, no matter how similar their lecture notes are, because they're coming from the same source, but they're all independently created.
I'm going to throw a big topic at you.
Sure.
The internet. Okay, I'm a digital immigrant. I hear that there's a distinction made between digital natives, the people who were born into this, and mm-hmm. I'm not one of those, if it's not obvious.
I don't think anyone in this room is.
But here we are with the technology to allow people in their garage to make high-quality music, mm-hmm. and you can self-publish publish books. You can make photographs that are outstanding. And mm-hmm. and know that we briefly, before this podcast began, we talked about gatekeepers. Can you talk a little more about how everything is being changed by
sure.
all this?
So if we go back in time to back when I was in high school in the late 70s, early 80s, and if I wanted to buy an album, I went down to the record store, and there all the music companies had sent albums, and I went down there and bought it.
I remember those days.
Yes, remember those days?
Yes.
So what it was, if you wanted to record an album, it cost a lot of money. You needed a soundproof room. You needed expensive equipment. And the only people who really had that were the recording studios. And they were going to take a risk on you. They were going to spend a lot of money getting those albums made, getting the recording made, getting those albums made on the master tapes, pressing the albums, making high-quality cassettes, getting them distributed out to the places. So they're the group that, you know, not a pejorative word, they're what we would call the exploiters. They're the ones who were necessary to get everything out there. And they were investing a lot of money in the artists to do this. And back then, infringers were also big players, people who could take a master and make lots of copies. Because when I was in high school and my boyfriend made me a copy of Pink Floyd's The Wall, and it's this double album that runs for like 8 hours, it took him 8 hours to make that cassette. And long past the statute of limitations, yeah. So I'm not worried about getting him in trouble. But that's what was required. And the quality wasn't very good, but that's what we did. And they didn't care about us. They cared about the big players who got hold of masters who made unauthorized copies, which is why we have such high dollar amounts for these statutory damages, because those were the players. So we had these gatekeepers, and they would listen to a song or they'd read a book, and they would decide, yes, this is something I want to invest money in to get out there. I think this is something that's a good return. So then things moved in a little more direction. Then we got digital. Even before we had the whole internet, things went digital. We had CDs. So basically, those songs on a CD, what they are is a digital file. They're a digital file. And we make copies of files all the time. We send them through the internet now. We send them on emails. But we have digital files. Those are very high quality, and they're not going to degrade like that song being put on the CD, on the cassette, time and time again. So we had that step. Okay, and suddenly everything went digital. You had very high quality. And now, to that 4-hour album takes about 3 minutes to make a copy of. So then, but even distributing, even if I made a whole bunch for my friends, nobody could find me. I was handing them out to my friends. That's the way it was. Then we got the internet. And we had companies like Napster. And Napster made it easy for me to find songs that other people had that I liked. And I could get a high quality download. Okay, so, but that also opened up the door for me to be able to build a studio. I think a fully soundproof studio. I had one student who actually researched this. It was less than $5,000 to build a soundproof studio and have everything equipped for music bands to come in and record their music. You can get software for a laptop to do all the recordings. So now you can have anybody who can make their album. They can put it on iTunes. They can put it on Amazon. They can sell it through their own website. So the gatekeepers, all this investment isn't necessary anymore, and others can go out and get their music out there, which means we hear a lot more songs that we never would have heard. We hear a lot of bad stuff. We hear a lot of good stuff, but we hear a lot more stuff in general. It's all out there because there's nobody deciding whether they should take a risk and invest all this money to get the music out there.
I'm thinking about the old days where if you were a musician and you wanted to make it big, you had to go begging
yes.
to have a studio take you on or a record label mm-hmm. take you on. But some benefits came with that because I assume they would take care of all the intellectual property and they would defend you or defend themselves because it's mostly they're making most of the money.
Well, actually, the studios were really bad. The studios insisted on complete ownership of their of the copyright. And they said they had everyone, they are saying, I am assigning my, for you to do this, you own the copyright forever, record company. And the record companies forgot about something in the Copyright Act, section 203, that says forever isn't forever, forever is 35 years. And there is a section that says you have a 5-year window starting 35 years out to take back. All you have to do is give them notice and saying, I am taking it back. I am taking back ownership. They cannot argue. They are fighting it, of course. You have to give at least 2 years notice and at most 10 years notice. So by year 38, if you haven't done your notice, they own it forever until the copyright expires. But it's happening a lot now because the act became effective January 1st, 1978. So a lot of any assignment made after that date, now you're seeing them more and more. Beginning in 2013, a lot of works are coming back to the artists.
Do you have any examples of like well-known works where that's happened?
Well, right now, Paul McCartney is in dispute over some of his works, trying to get them back. But there's been a lot of pushback, but for the most cases, the artists are winning. One of the difficulties, though, is then the record company is claiming, well, you may own the song, the composition again, but we have physical ownership of the masters. So what are you going to do? And some bands are going back in and re-recording. Others, you know, Nirvana's out of luck. They can't be re-recording their stuff because Kurt Cobain is no longer with us.
Right.
So you run into that problem. But some of them are actually re-recording their masters, but they are gaining ownership of their works again. But what the kicker is, a lot of it is all about giving people equal footing at the negotiating table.
Yeah, I was thinking relicense. They can always relicense.
Exactly. Right. And the idea was is that when the artist first starts out, they really don't know what their stuff is worth. The record company is also taking a risk. So between the two of them, the record company is not giving them much because it may be a failure. 35 years later, we know its value. We know what it's worth. So now you can renegotiate and you can get a new license. They can relicense it. They can they can work on it again. There's something called the public domain. And the public domain pretty much means everybody owns it. Everybody can copy it. Starting this past January, for the first time in 20 years, works started entering the public domain again. Because of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the Term Extension Act extended it for 20 years. We had a 20-year period where nothing entered the public domain. Starting this past January, anything published in 1923 entered the public domain. January of 2020, anything published in 1924 will enter the public domain.
Are you hearing stories about people who just kind of grew and then they hit that moment where people are stealing their work and taking advantage of them? How would you advise somebody like that, young, starting out, hopeful, but...
Well, that's why it's so wonderful that we have volunteer lawyers and accountants for the arts, because they are a nonprofit and they will help these young artists secure their rights, make sure that they can get that, talk to them about registering their copyright so if someone does infringe, they can get the statutory damages. Because if the whole damages is $5, they're never going to recover. And they've lost what's important to them, though, is that they've lost control of their work. We are lucky here in St. Louis that there is an organization that will help these young artists. They have issues on, you know, setting up your business, getting contracts, doing taxation. So they have accountants that will help you with that. They have attorneys who will help you with your business needs. And it's pro bono.
It's a great way to do it.
It's a great way to do it. And I mean, personally, I'd rather have them do that than be handling a criminal case.
Yeah.
I want them using their expertise.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so glad that you've agreed to come back for a second episode, because I think we have a lot more to talk about. You've been listening to Yvette Liebesman, and this has been The Jury Is Out. We'll be back in another episode with more of Yvette Liebesman.
See you then.
John and Eric would like to hear from you. They invite you to email your comments and suggestions to comments@thejuryisout.law. To learn more about the dedicated trial lawyers of the Simon Law Firm, visit simonlawpc.com.